connect. You can raise your hand using the user icon. Participants should have declared their interest already. When they're participating, particularly interested in the potential bidders, making that explicit. Follow-up will occur via email outside the call. Participants can use a distribution list for discussion and a reminder that this call is being recorded. Our agenda this morning, this is the maximum time we'll spend. This is assuming we'll spend the full 90 minutes. This call may be shorter than that, depending on the discussions we have. We'll take about 5 minutes for the introduction and housekeeping. We've allocated up to 50 minutes to review the comments received on T2, to discuss the model for data classification and the data access, and then to have more discussion about it. We've allocated half an hour, 30 minutes, to review further discussions on data locations, and then we'll wrap up. The purpose of this group is to advise ICANN and to provide advice on key TMCH processes and high-level technical implementation issues. It's not our goal to design solutions. The goal is for ICANN to deliver a set of business requirements to the service providers selected out of the clearinghouse's RFI process. The technical discussion track has a substantial amount of time around three interrelated areas of discussion spread across multiple calls. We'll be talking about data locations, data access, and while not planned for today's call, we have talked about the past, and we'll talk about again communication protocols in use for the clearinghouse. I'd like to go ahead and jump right in to the confidentiality and data access topic, T2. Our objective is to receive input from the community on ways to classify data in the clearinghouse, and perhaps to propose appropriate access controls that meet community concerns. This requires that we tell the clearinghouse vendor that's selected, and hopefully will be selected soon, the business requirements. And within those requirements, we want to identify the classes of data to be held by the clearinghouse, the types of parties that may need to access that data, and how access controls need to be applied. We've enumerated a list of several classes of data that we are fairly confident will exist within the clearinghouse. So things such as the trademark strings, the auth credentials, trademark data itself, including the jurisdiction class and registered owner, supporting documentation, mark holder and agent contact data, domain registrant contact data information, authentication and validation history, other transactional information. And the first question, and I'd like to pause here, is ask, do we anticipate other kinds of data? Jonathan?
Hi, Jonathan Robinson. So I'm representing IP Roto as a potential vendor of the clearinghouse. My understanding of documents, I think it's the guidebook and others perhaps have made reference to rights other than trademarks. So when we talk about the data classes in the trademark clearinghouse, it's probably more effective to generalize into IP, using a term like IP strings potentially registrable as domain names or text strings deriving from IP, given that it seems that the documents envisage more than simply trademarks.
Uh, Good point. We will try to reflect that.
And I mean, I think it's a valid point. I wouldn't mind your confirmation that that is valid. I mean, my understanding is that the clearinghouse does envisage dealing with rights other than trademarks. In other words, perhaps denominations of geographic origin, certain types of copyright data, perhaps other forms of intellectual property.
Karen?
Sure. I think it's a good point and something that we can add to the list. You know, the list looks broadly at you know, the different types of data that will be involved, and part of the point of opposing it was to see if there was anything to be added. So thanks. Okay. I will try to keep the queue going forward. This is Chris Wright is next.
First of all, on the list of information there, that looks relatively good. I think everything's been captured there. So no issues with the list. But I just want to comment on some things that were said in the previous slides, and maybe I missed some things. But this is the first time that I have been aware that this group is about setting business requirements, not solution. And if I missed that, I apologize. But that does raise a concern to me now that I am aware of that. Registrars potentially and registries definitely are the ones that need to integrate into this clearinghouse. Just handing some business requirements over to whoever wins this tender and then letting them figure it out without the registrars and registries being involved in that actual technical solution doesn't sound right or correct or fair at all to me, especially when, if that were the case and I was the winner of the Trademark Clearinghouse, of which I'm not going to because I'm not tendering, but if I did and I was the winner, I would clearly build the solution that meets all the business requirements that has the least cost to me and could potentially be the biggest impact or biggest cost to registrars and registries. I don't know, especially when registrars and registries are a much bigger party, and that they'll actually be paying for the service. I don't know that it actually just makes sense just to throw a bunch of business requirements at an entity and let them design a solution that then a whole bunch of other players have to just be happy with.
So thank you, Chris. This is Karen Love speaking from ICANN. Just to comment, we have characterized it as trying to create business requirements, mostly because that is what we're trying to do at this stage. And particularly, you know, when in conceptualizing the IAG, it's really difficult to have a group of this size and time frame that we have build entire models for things. So I think that's what's intended to be conveyed on the slide is that we are gathering requirements from all of the parties that are in the IAG. Certainly once a provider is selected, it's not the intention that they go off and do their own thing without consulting anybody or all the needs of the the parties that are involved. And if you look at the RFI, I think that it's pretty clear that there's an expectation that there will continue to be the community engagement as the implementation goes forward.
So that was what I was, I guess, wanting to clarify, is that the Trademark Clearinghouse won't be given carte blanche to design the solution, and they then have to design a solution in conjunction with the other affected parties. That meets the business requirements.
Right. So it's certainly the intention that it meets the needs of all of the major stakeholders that are involved in this group in the community. Yep.
Do you have an idea as yet how that process will happen?
I think it's it's probably not to go through on this call, but certainly as we move through the end of this group when we get to the a more advanced stage on the selection, we'll be able to anticipate a plan and a timeline.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
Sure. I've got Tom Barrett next.
Yes, good morning, everybody. In terms of data classes, I think it's probably worthwhile to include the Sunrise and trademark claims history. I'm not sure. You say transactional information. My first impression of that was actually receiving payment from a trademark owner, different from actually the history of Sunrise and trademark claims for a particular trademark record. So I think it's probably worthwhile to add that as another data class here. And then the other data class, which is related to users, is perhaps more internal users. But for traceability and transparency reasons, to keep a history of the internal users, the authenticators and validators, and exactly what they did in the clearinghouse, what records they touched, so that we have a full traceability history of who did what during the history of the clearinghouse. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by internal users?
Sure. I'm talking specifically about the people who are doing the authentication and the validation. They are making a series of decisions using, for example, authoritative databases, and that needs to be captured as part of the clearinghouse. So, for example, and I'll add one more type of user in addition to those internal users. Those are the dispute providers. But whenever there's a potential dispute, you want to be able to go back and say, who did this authentication? What did they use as an authoritative source when they did the authentication? What was the effective date of the authoritative source they used? So that you can basically reconstruct the process they went through, what kind of training they may have had, what kind of other records they have touched to see if there's a pattern, perhaps they misunderstood the requirement, and you can go through and see a pattern through everything they did that might need to be reexamined as part of an audit type of process.
Okay, so that's another class of data, is that things that were included in the authentication and validation process.
Right.
Okay. Thanks. I have next Hong.
Well, thanks. I assume when we talk about data classes, we should be focusing on the mandatory function of trademark clearinghouse, which is designed to protect trademarks. Intellectual property rights is many categories, in addition to trademark rights. But clearinghouse, according to the policies, to register is to protect the trademarks, registered or not registered, but subject to certain conditions. I understand certain registry may need additional information and additional services from the trademark clearinghouse. That will be included in the additional value-added services provided by clearinghouse. I guess that's not a part of things we are talking about. So the data we're talking about here is solely about trademarks. I don't believe we need to think about the expansive scope to cover geographical indication, copyright, design, or other category of intellectual property rights. So I'll get back to you, Karen.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that comment, Hong. I think you're correct that there's, that the central intentions have to do with the protection of trademark and the storage of trademark data. There was, a little bit of discussion, during the development about, what the scope would be. And then there was also, the idea that the the clearinghouse could be used to authenticate other types of requirements that a registry might develop, you know, on kind of an ad hoc basis. So there is that possibility that the clearinghouse could do those types of functions, even though it would not be, you know, one of the mandatory functions. And so maybe a class of data, and not the one that we're primarily concerned with, but maybe one class of data for the list is data having to do with ancillary services or other, you know, specialized, you know, registry processes that the clearinghouse may be involved in. Okay, I see no more hands. Do we have, are there more slides on this bill, or is there?
There's one, of course. Okay. But then I'll go ahead and proceed to our next big question, is enumerating who is going to interact with the clearinghouse. And I will, you know, we enumerated the mark holders and their agents, the registries, the registrars, domain name applicants, domain name registrants, and the general public, and I will verbally include internal users here. Are there other parties that may be interacting that need to be granularly identified that haven't been? Oh, yeah, dispute providers. Looks like we've got a hand.
Yep, Chris?
Hi, Chris again. So on this one, I would just say that I would classify these as potential parties who may need to interact with the Trademark Clearinghouse, because depending on the final solution, for example, registrars may never actually need to interact with the clearinghouse. They might do that by proxy through the registry, or so forth. So I wouldn't put these as definite yet. But everyone on your list is a potential party that may need to interact with the clearinghouse.
Okay, thank you. I'm just looking at the chat here. Tom is also pointing out that potential dispute providers would be a class that might interact, or a group who might interact.
Okay. I think we'll definitely have to include dispute resolution providers, and we may need to more granularly identify internal users, specifically the validators.
Okay, I've got Jonathan next.
Thanks, Karen. I think so internal users, there's clearly going to be a hierarchy of internal users, as well as things like mark holders and their agents. But my impression is, if you've caught internal users, people who are not customers of the clearinghouse but data processing agents of some description, you've covered that. I suppose the other thing is that domain name applicants really come in via two routes. They are either applicants who are making an application on the basis of having a mark, in other words, Sunrise applicants, or they are domain name applicants who come from an entirely different route. They're applicants for domain names in during the IP claims phase, in which case they're interacting in a very different way. So it's probably just worth at least bearing that in mind, although in principle you've covered it by domain name applicants. They interact with very different purposes depending on if they're a Sunrise applicant or an IP claims related applicant.
Okay, good. Thank you. Have Chris?
Yeah, I'm just having a hard time seeing how domain name applicants, so potential registrants, I guess we're saying by that, and registrants would interact with the clearinghouse. Surely domain name applicants only interact with the registrar, and that's it, which is kind of why I was saying potential before. I'm just having a hard time visualizing a solution where a domain name applicant needs to interact directly with the clearinghouse. Is someone able to give an example?
Well, I was going to respond, but I've got several hands raised, so I'll let Jonathan go next.
Thanks, Karen. Hi, Chris. I mean, certainly one view of things might be that, in effect, mark holders, it is true to say that the mark holders themselves are domain name applicants. By virtue of putting a mark in the clearinghouse, it's in there for one of two reasons, either as a domain name applicant for a Sunrise domain name and or as an IP claims, as an IP claim or prospective IP claim. So to that extent, mark holders and domain name applicants may be the same thing. And I agree with you, they may not interact directly with the clearinghouse in the way that it might appear here.
Yeah, your definition, I would argue, is handled by the first bullet point, whereas domain name applicants is a broader set that includes mark holders that are applying for domains, but also a whole bunch of other people.
Okay, Tom is next in the queue.
Yeah, I believe the intent here was that if a applicant received a claim that the claim notice may not contain everything he needs to know to determine if he is potentially infringing on a trademark. And based on how the data might be distributed, he might have to actually go to a web-based query interface or click on a link to actually get more information about the trademark that triggered the claim, so you can find out, in fact, if he is planning to use his domain name in a way that might infringe on that trademark. Go ahead.
Tom, you're exactly right in that is a perfect example of where a domain name applicant might need to interact with the clearinghouse. But I do believe that, at least based on the current wording in the guidebook, the intention is that the notice that is served to a potential applicant before they agree to go to head contains all the information he could possibly need, which is actually one of the big concerns that registry and registrars have, is that in order to display all that information, they either need to have the information or the trademark clearinghouse must have 100% availability. So, but yes, that is an example of a scenario where it might be required if that other requirement can be dropped.
Okay, I've got Will Shorter next.
Yeah, Tom covered the use case I was going to put in. Thanks.
Okay, sure, thank you. I was just going to add that, you know, the potential domain name applicant or potential registrant, you know, I think of interact with the clearinghouse, you know, interact use loosely, you know, where they get a notice that originates somehow from a query or from a record that's in the clearinghouse. So, you know, they may not realize that they're, quote, interacting, but they are, you know, kind of a party that is a major user of the system or a major participant in the system. Let's say so in that sense they are a party that's affected. Tom?
Yeah, you know, as another party you might interact with the clearinghouse, and we have this one of the requirements is to have some community engagement to talk about what new ancillary services there might be, to generate all types of reports in terms of whether or not the clearinghouse is meeting the needs of the community. So it's not so much it's the general public here, but also the interested folks within the ICANN community who might want to have input to how the policies in the clearinghouse evolve. So in a way, it's, I guess, this policy committee. If it continues on, want to interact with the clearinghouse as well. And I wonder, just stepping back to the previous slide in terms of classes of data, if we should also just include a catch-all in terms of reports that the clearinghouse is generating, which may be a a summary of all this data, but may somehow be aggregating it in some way as well, in terms of statistics and metrics.
Okay, anything else on this slide or the last couple of slides?
We've got a chat comment from Chris, which I'm just reading real quick. okay. Then the final part of the classification model is to talk about how we need to control the access and use of information for various classes of data and various types of users who interact with the clearinghouse. We came up with four general classifications where the first two are kind of global. There's an internal function, and there would probably be some internal differentiation. So like administrative users would have more privilege than non-administrative users and that kind of thing, you know, normal IT security models there. There's public information, which would be published or distributed without restriction. And then we have two classifications which are fairly similar. A partner classification to limit distribution to specific parties, and then a restricted classification, which limits it to specific parties, but also would prescribe procedural or technical measures to protect the information. And so there will probably be multiple descriptions of partner, depending on the context of what information and which partner is involved, and multiple descriptions of restricted for the same potential groups of who and what data. So the leading questions here are, which parties should qualify for partner or restricted access for which data classes? And are there special controls we need to require for particular classes of restricted data? And looks like we've got a question from John, or a comment from Jonathan.
Bill, thanks. I think there's two comments. One, first of all, on the public, the way in which you've phrased that is perhaps a little too wide for my comfort, in that you've said information may be published or distributed without restriction. Well, I would expect in any event the way in that was published, if, for example, it was via a website, there would be certain contractual terms that were in place for any users of that website. Now, you might argue, how can you enforce that and so on, but you can also enforce that kind of thing by acceptable use or rate limiting. Various functions could be put in place. So I think that's a little bit loose to just say published or distributed without restriction. I mean, I think there would be some forms of restriction there. And then on your other two classes, on partner and restricted, I would certainly think that this may sound trite, but these would be limited as required by the function that they're being used for. I mean, it's hard to say in abstract what the limits would be without knowing what the function and purpose of the access is. So, for example, if it was IP claims, it might be on the basis that domain name was being looked up, or that there was an equivalent availability check, or there could be various ways in which it was done, but it's more difficult to say without the sort of use cases or the examples.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of chatter in the chat room that I'm behind on now.
That's okay. I don't think it's on this specifically. But I think we had, if I'm not mistaken, we had, shown a table similar to this in the session we had in Dakar, and there was a lot of interest in you know, how is this table going to get filled in? And one of the questions that I typed in the chat was, you know, that was a sort of a first cut at how we might approach looking at this question of data access. And so, you know, the kind of big picture question that I posed on the chat is whether, as a framework, this makes sense. The distinctions are clear, and they be fit for the you know, types of data that we're going to be talking about and trying to you know, create parameters for.
Right.
And we've got some questions in the chat that we can look at in regard to that. Is there anyone?
Instead of typing, I might as well just speak what I was about to say. A domain name applicant going to the Trademark Clearinghouse directly, in my opinion at least, would come in under that public role because they're no different to anybody else. I'm pretty sure that none of the technical solutions, at least that I'm aware of, will require a domain name applicant to have any more access to the registry than what a public entity would have. In the terms of generating the claims notice, and what it all comes down to is what your definition of access to the registry is. If somebody does something via a third party, do you declare that access? And to make things simple, I probably wouldn't declare that access, but a registry or registrar, and I'm going to group the two of them together for the moment, registry, registrar, interact with the registry, probably at restricted access level, has access to the restricted data of all the domain names. But they only display the restricted data relevant to the current domain that the applicant is trying to register to the domain name to the domain name applicant. So they don't have any extra access to the registry. They can't just arbitrarily put in domain names and get back all that restricted information. The registry or the registrar has that level of access and uses that to construct the display that is displayed to the domain name applicant. So I would argue that the domain name applicant only has public access to the registry because when they go to www.trademarkclearinghouse.com or whatever the URL is going to be, all they can do is what the publics can do. When they're interacting with the Trademark Clearinghouse via a registrar, which may be via a registry as well, I mean, we don't know exactly how that's going to work, but when they're interacting with it that way, they are only seeing the data that the registrar's giving them to see, and that's because that registrar has access to that data and so forth. Unless, of course, and this is what I said before, all of this sort of presupposes a technical solution, which is all a bit, you know, the two are kind of linked a bit closely. Unless, of course, the way in which the claims notice is generated is that the registrar redirects with some sort of URL redirect or something to the Trademark Clearinghouse, and the Trademark Clearinghouse generates the notice, and then the registrar frames that up in the page, then you could technically argue that anybody could grab that little URL if they were smart enough to open up the HTML and split it out and blah, 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 and input that URL into the bar and get that information displayed. Thus, not just potential domain name applicants, public could get access to all that data if they could reverse engineer that URL, if there was no authentication in that URL. But I would argue then that basically the information that's contained within a trademark claims notice would be somebody who is at public access level. So if the information that's meant to be in a notice to a potential applicant is too sensitive to be public information, then the claims notice essentially needs to be authenticated somehow that this entity has the ability to see that, in which case the implementation solution for registrars becomes a little bit more, not a lot, but a little bit more complex. So they're all trade-offs all over the place, which, the whole solution needs to be looked at end-to-end, but yeah. My actual question, though, is I'm not, just based on the text in the description, I'm not 100% clear on what we're trying to say the difference is between a partner and a restricted person. So if someone can clarify that, that would be great.
I think the original intent when we wrote this was to differentiate, basically to clarify that there might be more stringent controls. Restricted would be a subset of part would could be a subset of partner with more restrictive controls.
Get access to any additional information?
Are you asking whether they might have access to additional? Yes, they might have. I mean, a restricted. The model when we were coming up with this model, the model had to do with understanding that we might, for instance, to pick a fairly concrete example, we talked about sharing the trademark strings, and partners would be able to do that under one set of restriction, under a fairly general set of restrictions on use that would probably be contractual largely, maybe with some technical implementation to protect it. Whereas information, it might be necessary, depending on how the on the clearinghouse model, it might be necessary for the registrar to have restricted access to specific claims data, namely the claims data for the claims data for a specific domain being registered.
I think I get your distinction now. I understand. So one is, hey, you get a dump of a subset of the data that there are some terms and conditions around what you can do with it, but we don't really dictate how that works too much and so forth. Whereas the other one is, here's this interface that you can use to query, and this interface gives you access to this data, and it's all dictated essentially how it works.
Yeah, exactly.
And what you can do with it. Okay, yeah, I get that. That makes sense.
Okay, I've got Will Shorter in the queue.
Yeah, on the data use, if you don't want to define, who the partners are in these requirements to say that there are partners, then I agree with William's point about actually, maybe making restricted a sub bullet under partner, and just identifying the fact that different parties are going to have different levels of access defined on whatever privileges they're provided for different data points. Otherwise, you could literally just communicate what all the parties are, and through your matrix there, through your provide the actual who gets what access.
I think it's also worth noting that registries and registrars here, whatever they fall into, partner or restricted or so forth, all they're really attempting to doing is validate data that the potential registrant already gave them. And we just need to keep that in the back of our mind when we're talking about what data they have access to and so forth and blah, blah, blah. But all they're trying to do is validate information that they already got given. So the registrant has already volunteered the information to the registrar / registry.
So just on that point, this is a little shorter. Is the domain name applicant always going to provide the detail about their trademark? Or are they going to provide a domain create request with their registrant information?
That's a good question. Chris, sorry, speaking. That's a good question. If you look at all the launches, most of the launches to date, like the affiliates.info launch and the newstart.biz launch, during the sunrise phase, the registry actually required that not just the registrant information, but all of the trademark information was supplied to the registry as part of the sunrise registration request or sunrise application request, if you want to call it that. And if you actually find one of the initial names, for example, in info, that was applied for during the sunrise phase and you do a who is on that name, you'll actually find that all the trademark information is returned in that who is query. So not registrant information, trademark information, which you could argue is registrant information because it belongs to the registrant, but specifically trademark information was required to apply for a name during sunrise and is still today returned in Whois responses.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, that's true. Jonathan, next.
Thanks, Karen. Chris, I don't know if this will help clarify things or not, but my understanding of the data flows is there are essentially two sort of macro ways in which the data may flow these days. The first is what you described a moment ago, which and that data is put in via the registrar, submitted to the registry, and then validated against one or more databases, which we might call post-application validation. A variant which might occur in parallel or as an alternative to that is where validation occurs prior to domain name application, and that data is then wrapped up in some way and used to apply for the domain name, and that would be post-validation application. So there are really two, as far as I understand it, two or more macro methods for running Sunrise where things have evolved to. And my understanding is that we're largely talking about the latter at the moment rather than the former, the more sort of classical data flows. But that's a very interesting point, and I think it comes to the heart of this and the sort of depth of participation we've got here and more generally and quite how we handle all of these things, because it's clear that however the solution is implemented, it's either got to be then given a great degree of education out into the market and or prior consultation before it's designed in full. Thank you.
Sorry, was that Tom?
Sorry, Chris, it was Jonathan Robinson.
Jonathan, I couldn't agree with you more. That is exactly the point. There are two very similar but distinctly different methods that could happen here. And forgive me for paraphrasing what you just said, but I'm going to do it so that you can correct me if I understood you wrong. Method one is where the potential registrant supplies as much of the trademark information as they can or as is needed to the registrar/registry, which then gets verified and then the domain name is registered. So it gets supplied as part of the registration, and that is what you're referring to as a post-registration validation or post-application validation. And the second method is where we have this entity, the Trademark Clearinghouse, that validates the data for us already, and then when you apply for a domain name, we just get some sort of thing that tells us that this is the name of the trademark that they have, and you don't have to worry about the details, registrar, registry, because the Trademark Clearinghouse has already vetted that for you. So you can just give them the name. So Trademark Clearinghouse has already figured out that they're ready for it and blah, blah, blah. And you can give them the name and so forth. And that's the second method. And obviously from a registrar perspective, the second method is much much better for us. It's a lot less work for us and so forth. So that's great. But there are a couple of things that get in the way of that. One is the TLD namespace may have additional eligibility requirements beyond just presence in the clearinghouse, and those eligibility requirements may require information about the trademark. For example, TLD.finance might require, the eligibility-wise, that you must have a trademark in the class for finance, whatever that is, not a trademark lawyer, so I forgive me. But so in order to do that, they don't need to know just that there's a trademark in the clearinghouse and it's been vetted. They need to know that the trademark in the clearinghouse that has been vetted is this particular class. And so that's one example. Another one might be, for example, a geographic TLD. I don't know, let's say someone does .Melbourne or .New York or so forth. An eligibility requirement for that TLD may be that you have a trademark, a valid trademark, where the address on that trademark or the address of the entity or so forth is in New York. So then they would need access to that information to verify that. Now, the registrant has the decision whether to go for a .New York name or not. So they have the decision whether to supply that information or not. But as part of applying for that .New York name, they either need to supply their trademark clearinghouse reference, which is the reference to their validated trademark, and then give the registrar slash registry the right to get the address information, for example, in this case, from the clearinghouse so that they can verify the eligibility from the clearinghouse. Or alternatively, the registry registrar can just use the trademark clearinghouse identifier to go, yes, that's a validated trademark, but then ask the registrant to supply the other information that goes along with the trademark, in which point they volunteer that information. But then the registry registrar still would have to independently verify that information. So if they didn't get that information from the clearinghouse, they would have to independently verify it. Whereas the clearinghouse presumably has already verified all of that information. So there are a lot of corner cases, a lot of edge cases, which, and I'm fairly confident that given the volume of TLDs we're about to release out there, every TLD is going, well, not every, but there are going to be a lot of TLDs that have these restrictive eligibility policies in place because that's their differentiation out there in the market. And these registries might be assuming, and that might be incorrect, I don't know, but these registries are probably assuming that they're going to be able to use, especially during the sunrise phase, they're going to be able to use the information in the clearinghouse to verify eligibility. I hope I was clear, and if I confused anyone, let me know.
Shall I just comment in brief replies to that, Karen? It's Jonathan again.
Sure, if you'd like.
Yes, thanks. Chris, I thought you were very clear. You understood the case as I described, and you extended it beyond that. The solutions to deal with that, I have some ideas on, but you're right. There are more complex additional scenarios, but the core scenarios we are speaking the same language on, and you were perfectly clear. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, and just to follow up on that discussion, we have one of the things that people have raised through the process is they want the model to be flexible, to be able to use by registries. We have a basic process that registries can adapt to their unique circumstances, and one of the things that keeps coming up is this eligibility aspect that may come into play in some cases. You can design a really great streamlined process that is very efficient for everyone when it comes to validating the trademark data, but there's still how we work in these extra steps per registry not knowing what they are is one of the complexities that's still with us. Is that Chris?
Yeah, he was. I was just going to say, I think we just have to be clear to people that, hey, you put your entry in the clearinghouse, because at the end of the day, it actually helps registrants by keeping domain prices low. If they can enter their information in one place in the clearinghouse and the clearinghouse validates that information and then the registries can get access to all that validated information, then the registries don't need to charge, or the registry slash registrars don't need to charge, big validation fees, because now they have to have people go and validate this data and so forth. So it is actually in the registrant's interest to do that in most cases, at least from my point of view. I think as long as it's clear to trademark holders that says, by putting your information in the clearinghouse, if you then go and attempt to register a domain name referencing your clearinghouse registration, your clearinghouse entry, if you try to register a domain name referencing your clearinghouse entry, you are consenting to giving the registrar slash registry the ability to see all the information associated with your registration, then we don't have a problem. And if the registrant or the potential registrant is not happy with that, then they just don't apply for the name.
Okay, thank you. Are we Are we at the time on this, Bill?
We are just about there. If there are any last comments people want to get in before we move on to the next topic. Then I'm going to go ahead and this topic will be continued on future calls. I captured some of those discussion bullets again on this slide, so we can. I think we've covered this ground fairly well, unless anyone wants to add anything. All right. Then let's go ahead and move into data locations. We had a pretty lively conversation on the 16th of December, largely centered around concerns for misuse and abuse of clearinghouse data. The consensus appears to be that distribution of clearinghouse data should occur only when necessary to implement clearinghouse functionality. It should be justified by technical performance, uptime, availability, and economic factors, and should, at a minimum, have contracted restrictions on use. We also discussed the distribution of trademark strings for lookup, that it might be performed via DNS, and we discussed that in some detail, talking about times to live and refresh and how that gets implemented and how that works. We also were talking about local copies and caching needing to have refresh and retention policies and requirements, and the consensus seems to center around the once per day data point. But that was not a strong consensus. That was might have only been a repeated view. Let's go ahead and jump into the discussion on this. Looks like Jonathan has a comment.
Thanks. It's Jonathan again. I worry a little bit about the use of the term distribution, because in many ways the location of the data is not the issue, and I realize that that may be implicit to everyone, but the fact that it is distributed per se is not the risk or it's the permissions on the data that's really the issue. So in fact, distribution might enhance performance, but it's really about how, at what level this data is accessible and to whom. Regardless of whether it's all located in one place or in multiple places. I mean, the distribution is primarily, I would think, a performance issue rather than one of misuse and abuse or security. So we've got to be careful we don't sort of try and solve the wrong problem or a different problem with a different element of the solution. So that's just my sort of general comment on the way in which we word and frame this. Because, as I say, I don't think distribution per se is the problem. It's more about how one permits access and for what reason.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else want to come in here?
I'll have a go if no one else is going to say anything. I don't want to monopolize the time.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. So I don't even know where to start. Distribution of trademark strings for lookup may be performed using DNS, leveraging TTL refresh implementation. If anyone has read my post to the list, they probably know that I'm a big advocate for this way of looking up trademark data, although there is the IDN issue, so I'll park the IDN issue for later, though. Essentially, really, there's only a few, and again, speaking from a registrar perspective, there's only a few things that registry and registrars want to know. The first thing that we want to know, and we want to know this thing really quickly, and we want to know it all the time. We don't want ever there to be a situation where we can't find this out. We want to know, does a particular string exist in the trademark clearinghouse? And I don't care if it exists for multiple people. I don't care if there are five different trademarks registered to this, or if there's only one, or if there's 100. I don't care who owns the trademark. Or the first thing that I want to know, and I want to know this quickly, is does the particular name that somebody is trying to register conflict or match or whatever word you want to use, a name that's in the clearinghouse? And I need to do this every time somebody's essentially doing what is an EPP domain check command. Every time someone does a domain check command during the sunrise phase, I need to know, is it on the list? This proposed DNS solution that's been proposed seems like a really good way to do this. What are we talking about? We're talking about matching domain names. What matches domain names really well? DNS. What system do we already have that exists that distributes zone files full of domain names? Well, that's the DNS as well. We have the zone transfer protocol and blah, blah, blah. And the only bit of information we're talking about here is there is an entry in the database that matches this name. And registry and registrars, they just happen to deal in DNS all the time. So they know this DNS protocol backwards. They know how to deal with it. They know how to program to it. They know how to query it. This sort of solution here just makes sense. So what does that mean for data location? Well, that means everybody who's interested in querying this service has a copy of a particular zone file that contains a list of every trademark that is in the clearinghouse. I'm not sure that that's sensitive information. I don't think it's sensitive information to know, hey, there's a trademark on the word Coke. We don't know who holds it, who has it, why it exists, what class it's in, when it happened. We know nothing except for the fact that, hey, there's a trademark that exists for the word Coke. So I think that, in terms of data location, who cares where that ends up? That could be, someone could put it on a website and everyone in the world could download it and it could be everywhere. It doesn't really matter from that one. That's from my perspective. If there's an argument as to why that shouldn't be or why that is a security concern or so forth, I'd love to hear it and know what it is. And then we'll rethink our proposed solution based on that. So that's the third sub-bullet point under the first bullet point. I think that's the best way to go there. The second second time that registry registrars need information from the clearinghouse is when, oh, potentially, I should say, let's flag this for potentially needs information from the clearinghouse is when they need to, they've determined that, hey, this domain you're about to register or attempt to register is in the clearinghouse. So now we're obligated, or the registries are obligated via our contract with ICANN, to display to that potential registrant a trademark claims notice of a form, of the form in the guidebook. To generate that notice, there's certain more information that's required other than just the domain name. Now, I don't know who decided what this notice should look like and who, you know, said this information should be on the notice. I don't know who decided that. But at the moment, as the guidebook stands, we have to, as a registry, ensure that this person sees a notice that contains these things before they register the name. So by very definition of the requirement that we need to meet, registries need access to this information. However, registries don't interact with registrants. Registrars do. So the registrar is the entity that needs to display this notice to the registrant. Now, the registrar can either get this information via the registry, which kind of seems a little bit pointless, or the registrar could get the information directly from the clearinghouse. So the registrar could also use some tricky little technical things, HTTP redirects, blah, 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 to redirect the registrant to the trademark clearinghouse so the trademark clearinghouse can display this notice to them. The whole point about all this, though, is that this data is going to be freely available. The data on this notice is going to be freely available. If I was malicious for some reason and I wanted to find out who owned the trademark for Coca-Cola, I could potentially just go to a registrar's site, try to register the domain Coca-Cola, get the trademark claims notice by whatever mechanism we decide. It's kind of irrelevant how we decide if it goes in email, if it comes from via the registrar, via the registry, or directly from the clearinghouse. It's kind of irrelevant how it gets to me. I am going to get this notice that says the domain name you are about to register clashes with, matches, whatever, these trademarks registered in the clearinghouse by very definition of the requirement. So anyone that argues that that information should be private, it's kind of irrelevant. It's public information by very definition. So unless we want to change the content of that notice, and I don't know what the process is for changing the content of that notice, how that was decided in the first place, and so forth. So then the question is about people that, obviously, as a public person, it's very time-consuming for me to try and mine that database and potentially try to register, you know, 1,000 domain names to get all the conflicting trademark data, blah, blah, blah. It's possible, but it's not feasible. So then we have to be concerned about the people that do have the automatic access to this data, the programmatic, the API access to this data. Because those people, it's probably pretty trivial for them to mine the data out of it. Now, that can be handled several different ways. That can be handled by the Trademark Clearinghouse being told to monitor these things. Of course, though, how do you tell if GoDaddy is trying to mine the data or actually having that many registrations going through their web interface? Yeah, that's a pretty hard thing to know. You could do trend analysis and so forth and blah, blah, blah. But you could put the onus on the Trademark Clearinghouse to make sure that their programmatic APIs are not being abused. That's one way. Another way is you could make it so that these entities, registrars and registries, don't have access to this data. But in order to do that, that means the Trademark Clearinghouse needs to serve these notices. And you're kind of just moving you're not solving the problem, you're just moving the problem from the registrars to the clearinghouse. The problem still exists. The clearinghouse still needs to be looking at who's using these APIs, which, you know, how, or using these interfaces. They might not be APIs, they might be just a predictable URL or so forth. And, you know, the clearinghouse needs to have the mechanisms in place to protect this data. But the data has to be public by very definition of the requirement. The third thing that registries and registrars need to do is, well, let's say potentially need to do, is they need an indication from the clearinghouse that the information that this registrant has supplied them is verified and correct. So otherwise, this whole thing is pointless. If as a registry I get some sort of thing that matches up to an entry in the clearinghouse, if I can't verify that thing and I can't verify that the person that gave me the thing is the person that does it, etc., this whole thing is pointless. So I need an ability to do that. The challenge with this one is that this one kind of has the same requirements as that checking domain name availability. If that interface is not available, I still can't process domain names. However, I don't need this for serving claim notices. I only need this during the Sunrise process. And I don't necessarily need to validate Sunrise registrations in real time. I can accept the registration, put it in my database at the close of my Sunrise period, validate them against the clearinghouse. So I can probably tolerate downtime with that sort of validation thing and so forth. So from that perspective, the clearinghouse could provide an API with, you know, some sort of SLA around it, doesn't matter, or they could just provide a service where I send the clearinghouse a file of all my registrations and the clearinghouse sends me back a thing with yes, no, this one's valid, this one's not, etc., because I don't need to do these things in real time. So you have to consider each of those three different use cases independently. You have to consider the data involved, and you have to consider, basically what the data is being used for and what that means for it being publicly available and so forth. And I talked too much, sorry.
There's some discussion in the chat, and I'm catching up on real fast. Go ahead, Tom.
I would say one of the concerns that I've heard quite a bit from the trademark owners in the group is that with the dot brand emergence as a type of registry, that a dot brand obviously is a trademark owner that has competitors, and by virtue of being a registry, it has access potentially of a competitor's strategy for protection of the new TLDs. And so there's a lot of concern on the list that these dot brand registries, in fact, may have access to data about their competitors that they would rather not provide access to. And so I think that's the concern about making all the data freely accessible, certainly to other registries that might data mine it for purposes other than running the registry itself.
I certainly understand that concern, but I guess on the way the requirements currently are in the guidebook, that's unavoidable. If I should be so bold to say that. So I'm not sure if again if anyone's had a chance to read some of the emails that I've posted, but so use case number one, the use of a zone file, or as Francisco is indeed saying in the chat, just basically a list of names, regardless of how that, if DNS is the mechanism used to distribute that list or some other mechanism used, is kind of irrelevant. He's correct there. Basically, a list of names being available to the registrar's registries, I'm assuming that that's a no-brainer and everybody's okay with that one. Moving on to the third one, the one about where the registry needs access to authenticated data during the Sunrise process, the solution that we proposed was essentially having the trademark clearinghouse validate the data and then GPG sign or PGP sign that data using a private public key pair, and then giving that signed mass of data back to the trademark owner. Then if the trademark owner wished to use that data to register a domain name during Sunrise, all it needed to do is supply to the registrar/registry that signed chunk of data that the registry uses the public key of the trademark clearinghouse to verify. Given that, so the data can't be modified, that's what cryptography does, data can't be modified, the registry can validate the signature that the trademark clearinghouse made on that data, and if it validates the signature, it knows that this data has been validated by the clearinghouse, the registry can then do what it wants with it, it doesn't matter, and the registrant has, or the potential registrant has voluntarily given that data to the registrar registry. The registry never needs access to the clearinghouse to get the data. There's no interface between the registry registrar and the clearinghouse. All that's required is all the registry registrars need to know the public key of the trademark clearinghouse. And all that's required of the trademark clearinghouse is that it signs the data with its private key, provides that signed package to the people who put the information in the clearinghouse. When they apply a Sunrise, they give it. We use the public key of the clearinghouse to validate the data, and we're done. It's relatively simple. This also has the advantage that the clearinghouse can put validity time periods on the data. So the clearinghouse can say, hey, I validated this data, but it needs to be revalidated every year. So the signature that the clearinghouse generates over the data could be valid only for a short period of time. And that means that people have to keep their information in the clearinghouse up to date, because if they still want to rely on it for domain name registrations or potentially even for URS and other processes down the road, they would need to supply data with a valid signature that hasn't expired. So that has a lot of other advantages as well. The one disadvantage of this method is that what happens if the clearinghouse accidentally gives out a signature in error? The clearinghouse does need to maintain a list of signatures that it's given out in error, which is equivalent to your certificate revocation list in certificate authorities, that registrars and registries need to be aware of, so that they know if somebody tries to register a name using this signature with this ID, that one was given out mistakenly by the clearinghouse, thus you can't accept that one and away you go. So that's relatively trivial. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't trivialize it like that. That has a solution that may or may not be trivial. The other problem with it, and this is the biggest problem about it, is what happens if someone gets hold of that trademark clearinghouse private key? I could potentially go and generate a whole bunch of signatures now and so forth. But that just means that the clearinghouse needs to protect that key adequately, and that could be handled in requirements and so forth. So that solves number three really well. The only one that I don't have a really good solution for yet is number two. And number two, my best solution that I have to date is to redirect the when the trademark claims notice needs to be displayed, redirect the potential registrant to the clearinghouse to display the notice. Thus, the registry and registrar don't need the information to construct the notice. But the problem with that is that it means anyone can grab that URL and retrieve all that information from that notice at any point in time. So if we decide that the information on the trademark claims notice needs to be adequately protected, then that solution doesn't work. But aside from that, if you do use those three solutions, the only data that needs to be replicated beyond the clearinghouse is a list of trademarks in the clearinghouse. Aside from that, everything else stays in the clearinghouse and nobody else needs access to it.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I at least found it helpful the way you were breaking down the issues and the scenarios. And so the group knows, we are working on a compilation of all of the feedback, both the written submissions we received and the comments from conference calls. On the issues that we've raised, and so all of that is part of the record, and we'll be producing a summary version or a reference version to all the things that have been provided to the IAG. So,
I think Francisco had a question.
Yes, thank you, Bill. So, Tom. I'm not sure I understand what the issue with .brand. Would you mind clarifying?
Yes, I mean, one of the themes I've noticed from comments from trademark owners is a concern that registries who are in fact competitors of theirs because they're .brand would be able to determine their brand protection strategy among TLDs by examining which trademarks they had authenticated and validated. So to the extent that, so my impression was the trademark owners would prefer that there'd be a clearinghouse that can respond to requests to a sufficient SLA so that data does not need to be distributed to these registries and give them potentially competitive information.
So we're talking about the beyond the trademark strings, right?
Correct.
So that information as shown by the description that Chris gave, that can be accessed by basically anyone. They make it as if they were registering a domain name in any TLD, they will be able to get this information. So I don't see how this is relevant to having a .brand.
Well, it's not. The difference is, I think, is that trademark owners envision that a .brand is a bit more savvy about the portfolio of trademarks that their competitor has than someone who's doing a random registrant or applicant who's trying to register a domain name. So I think it gets back to the level of understanding of the registry in this case in terms of what its competitors might be doing, which enables it to do some more sophisticated data mining. For example, because they have access to online trademark databases, they can do owner searches of their competitors. They can detect which new trademarks their competitors are applying for in the trademark office, and then turn around and see if they have a strategy for protecting that in new TLDs, and that tells you, well, gee, that new trademark application is a pretty hot one for this competitor. You know, let's because they're clearly deciding to protect it even before they worry about some of their existing trademarks. So the issue is dot brands in particular can put their heads in the minds of their competitors.
So, Tom, just to clarify, is there a expectation that the clearinghouse is going to receive data directly from PTOs? Because it seems that, I mean, there are several steps here. I mean certainly. Trademark offices around the world, trademark registries around the world, they certainly receive their information and they publish it in various ways. In the U.S. and for the full EU, both of those databases are fully searchable and online, and they're free. So I think, that's probably it's a substantial percentage of the mark holders. But is the idea that, once you get your trademark, then you also have to register with the Trademark Clearinghouse. I think that, from a practical standpoint, there is going to be a lag, if not a gap, between what trademarks are registered in the various jurisdictions of the world and what trademarks are available from the Trademark Clearinghouse. I think as a practical matter, there's going to be a gap, and it might be very large.
Right.
And
I'm sorry, just to respond. So the concern is that, not all registered trademarks will, in fact, find their way into the clearinghouse. And it's that subset of trademarks that the comments have indicated they don't want to have make visible to the dot brand registries, right? Because that indicates a conscious decision on the part of the trademark owner. We're going to file for a trademark, let's say 20 trademarks in 20 jurisdictions, but these five are the ones we're going to care about in terms of protecting in the clearinghouse. And the comments I've read indicate that they don't want to make that information so readily available to their competitors, who in fact may be a dot brand registry.
Sorry, it's Chris again. I would argue that if the entity is concerned about that, if they think that by registering a trademark in the clearinghouse, that would indicate to a competitor that you're perhaps a bit more, you like that trademark better, or it's more important to you for some particular reason, and you don't want to give that information away, then if I was that entity, I would register that trademark and 10 other one of my irrelevant ones just to keep people off the track.
Yeah, that'd be a great comment to put on the list, Chris.
I don't know if I want all the replies.
So,
we have concerns of trademark owners that whether they're valid or not are apparently concerns of revealing competitive information to their competitors who might also be running a dot brand registry.
Well, we've got a comment from Hong on chat. To just read it out loud, if that's okay with you, Hong. They're raising the issue that if a mark holder makes 100 registrations in 100 different jurisdictions, and the clearinghouse aggregates information, that might expose more than could be obtained by scraping the publication from a single trademark office.
Right.
Which makes sense, but I think that my concern is that there's a missing step in that. It's the Trademark Clearinghouse aggregates the information provided by the trademark owner after they make those registrations. So the mark holder will make those 100 registrations and then will have to make the active choice to make those to register those marks with the clearinghouse. And then that information becomes mineable through the clearinghouse or potentially mineable, and that's where the area of concern comes from.
Yeah, and Hung has a good point, as you said, that is exactly right. That is what will happen after they put the information in there. But at the end of the day, let's be clear about it. Unless the requirement for the content of the trademark claims notice is changed, this is unavoidable. So those same trademark holders that are trying to protect this information are the same ones that want all this information in the claims notice. So it's kind of like cake and eat it too scenario. You've got to decide which one you would prefer. Would you prefer to protect against that competitive information and have the claims notice have far less information? Or do you want the claims notice to have all this information but expose yourself to that risk? I'm not a trademark holder, so I don't know what you guys would prefer, and I don't know who speaks for trademark holders, actually. I don't know who the appropriate entity is to ask that question to, but basically that's what the question is about. If you change the content of the claims notice, we can solve this problem. If you don't change the content, then you have this problem. There's nothing you can do about it.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes, and I have Hong in the queue, and then Tom. Hong?
Well, okay. I'm not particularly concerned about the competition issue, but since many people read that, it could be a disadvantage to trademark holders. So I try to imagine what would be negative to them. Well, think about such a scenario. I've a trademark registration, say, in 100 countries, and I've applied to clearinghouse. Is now I've got an entry with all these applications. My competitor, if they can access the information, this depend on the level of access we're going to define. Hypothetically, the competitor can access 100 registrations from 100 different jurisdictions. They would know in which country I don't have the registration. Say, I can see you've registered in 100 countries, but not registered in Japan. Then I can register the trademark in that country. I guess it's one concern the trademark owner is strongly hating this kind of publication by clearinghouse. Another possibility is that, trademark registration is by classifications. Say I registered in Japan, but I registered on class 35. I didn't register on a class 42. Well, that's very relevant to internet services. And my competitor saw this information. They may try to register in that category, in that classification. So these are concerns, the real concerns from trademark holders. So now my question is that if we provide access for the partners, well, even we don't know what would be the scope of the partners, whether these partners will be able to access the zone file, as some colleagues mentioned, or only the trademark, the string, without classification, without the country of registration, the clear information. Okay, back to you, Karen.
Thank you. I have Tom and then Margie.
Yeah, and again, I guess I just want to, we may be getting redundant, but I do think there's a difference between a registry, be it a dot brand or not, having the ability, or registrar, having the ability to display one claims notice versus having a cached library of all the claims notices that exist in the clearinghouse. And so I think the concern is if we don't need to, if we can build a clearinghouse that is scalable enough that can handle the load, then the preference is not to call to other registries so that it could be used for data mining purposes.
So Chris,
we're almost out of time for this call, and Margie.
I'll be really quick. Sorry about that. Let Margie go. Sorry.
This is Margie. Just in response to Hong's comments, I think a lot of the concerns you raise are already an issue now, even without a trademark clearinghouse being created. If you go to a Thompson & Thompson, for example, you can get a lookup of all trademarks that someone has registered in various jurisdictions by class. So I think some of this stuff is problems that brand holders are already dealing with and aren't necessarily exacerbated by a trademark clearinghouse.
All right. Okay. Chris, I'm gonna ask you to be prepared to send your comments to the list because we have about 60 seconds left on this call.
Understood. No worries. I think I can kill the issue, though.
Okay. These topics will continue to be discussed. Our next call is at 0 hour UTC 27 January 2012. Chris, we've got just a few seconds. Go ahead. If you can fit it in and say 20 seconds, let's go ahead and.
It's really simple. Look, all we're basically talking about here is is a dot brand registry making thousands of queries to the clearinghouse to get all this information? We deal with this all the time as a registry. We deal with Whois data mining issues. We deal with people trying to data mine from the Whois. All we're talking about here is that the Trademark Clearinghouse has to have mechanisms in place to detect when people are data mining. And if a dot brand registry is doing 3,000 queries or 2,000 queries or 100,000 queries or whatever a day to the Trademark Clearinghouse, then the clearinghouse is going to go, hey, what the hell's going on here? You're a dot brand registry. You register 3 domains a day. Why all the queries? Blah, blah, blah. Like, I think this is just a problem that you give to the clearinghouse and they can solve with the same stuff that we do when we try to detect people that are data mining Whois. That's it.
Exactly. Okay. So exactly. That'll have to be the last word for this call. But again, we do have our next technical track call on 27 January. There is a call this afternoon, this afternoon, I believe it's at 2100 UTC.
Depends where you are, whether it's afternoon.
I'm sorry. I would do the UTC afternoon, 2100. Almost evening, in fact. We will continue to accept comments on all of the technical issues. We ask that comments be received by 24 Jan to prepare for the next call. And again, please don't resubmit prior comments. Just send new recommendations and observations. I'd like to thank everyone for your time on this call, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all.
Bye.
Good night.